Today is Transitions Tuesday on Mind Talk. I am your host, Dr. Pamela Brewer. Mind Talk is the show that provides you with relationship health and mental health information every day. And on Transitions Tuesday, we focus on all things related to the many different kinds of transitions we all have occasion to experience in our lives. Today's guest is no different. I am very pleased to introduce to you Mark Wolin, who is a leading expert on inherited family trauma. What's that, you wonder? He's going to tell us in a second. Mark is the director of the Family Constellation Institute in San Francisco, where he trains clinicians and treats people struggling with depression, anxiety, panic disorder, obsessive thoughts, self-injury, chronic pain, and illness. Mark Wolin, welcome to Mind Talk.
Pamela, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, I have to start with asking you about the title of your book, which is entitled, It Didn't Start With You, How Inherited Family Drama How Inherited Family Trauma Shapes Who We Are and How to End the Cycle. So you have to explain what you mean by inherited family trauma.
Okay. So when we have a trauma, it changes us. So literally, it causes a chemical change in our DNA. And it doesn't change the sequence, but it changes how our genes function. And sometimes this new functioning because of the trauma can last for generations. So when we go to have kids or when we're kids, we're born, we don't come with a clean hard drive like we'd like to. There's already an operating system in place that contains the fallout from our traumas, our parents' traumas, maybe even our grandparents' traumas. And so when our children can be born and we can be born with fears and feelings that don't always originate with us. And that's when I talk about inherited family trauma, it's these unexplained fears that we can't latch them onto anything, these anxieties that either strike suddenly or we've carried our whole lives, or a depression that we never seem to get to the bottom of, because the root doesn't always live in the childhood. And so I've learned that these feelings, these experiences, they might not always be our own, Pamela, that we can be biologically inheriting from our parents, our grandparents, maybe even our great-grandparents, and it doesn't have to be this way.
Well, you know, I have two immediate reactions. On the one hand, I think we've all had the experience of either saying ourselves or talking with someone who says, well, I don't know why I think this, but, or I don't know why I feel this way, but. And it sounds like that's kind of a little bit of what you're talking about, that there are these things that we just sort of have in our experience and we're not quite sure why they're there. Is that a fair statement?
Very fair. In fact, when we have an obsessive thought or some fear that seems out of context with our life experience, I'm very interested to get somebody to keep talking, because I want that idiosyncratic language. I want that peculiar language, just what you're saying. When somebody says, why do I say I don't deserve to live? Or why do I say I'm going to lose everything? Or why do I have this fear I could harm my baby? Or those things. Yes, I'm fascinated with these, I don't know why I say that sort of thing.
All right, so that's one piece of what my initial reaction is to your description. But then the other piece is, so an infant coming into the world, in theory, with a clean slate, you're saying, hold on, not so much, the slate is not quite as empty as we imagined or would like to hope.
Okay, so scientists used to believe that we would come in with this clean hard drive, that somehow the traumas got wiped out, the whole disk is reformatted. But they found that some traumas escape this reformatting process, and that they're able to be transmitted, like it or not, into the next generation. Now they've done, they can show it for two generations in humans, they can show it for three generations in mice and rats. And the reason they pick mice and rats is because we share 99% of the same genetic makeup. So out of 30,000 genes, 29,700 are the same. So they can, I'm happy to talk about some of those studies as well. They're fascinating. I love the new research that's coming out in epigenetics.
Well, you know what? Why don't you give us an example of one of those studies? And because then I want to get into your personal story, because you've had some traumas as well.
I have. Let me talk about my favorite one done with mice, and then later on we can talk about the work done with humans.
Okay.
They wanted to show, or that whether they wanted to show or not, they showed that fear could be transmitted transgenerationally. And the way they've done this is they took mice and they introduced a scent, a cherry blossom-like scent, into the cage, and then they shocked the poor little mice every time it would smell the scent. And of course, the mice became jittery and freaked out and anxious. But they then examined the physiology, and they found that the brains had enlarged areas where those receptors that would detect the scent, so the mice could detect it at lower concentrations, and of course keep themselves safe if they could smell it at a lower concentration. So now that we've got changes in the brain, then changes in the blood, then changes in the sperm. Now, in the next, and then they took the male mice that were shocked, and they took the sperm and introduced it into female mice who were not shocked. Now, the next generation, they take the male mice again, who were not shocked, but they introduce that smell, and boom, those mice become jittery and anxious, and they're having the same trauma response, but they weren't shocked. They never had the trauma.
That's fascinating.
And then they test the brains and the blood and the sperm, same deal. Now the third generation is the most interesting. Smell again into the cage. Mice go crazy, get jittery, get anxious, but physiologically, biologically, those mice don't have the same physiologic changes, which lead the researchers to believe, aha, we can see it for 3 years that you carry the fear trauma, the response to the fear trauma, but maybe not after that.
Interesting. But for three years, they can actually, it goes across generations. That is fascinating research.
It blows my mind every time I see one of these studies. And they've studied certain groups of humans to show it in humans. In fact, in New York, there's this rock star neuroscientist named Rachel Yehuda. She's out of Mount Sinai Hospital Medical. And she did this two studies that were pretty famous, the one with Holocaust survivors showing mass trauma on a collective scale. And then she did it with the babies born to mothers who were pregnant at or near the World Trade Center when it was attacked on 9/11, and then they went on to develop PTSD. Well, these mothers had babies with PTSD, and Holocaust survivors that went on to develop PTSD had children with the similar symptoms of PTSD. Specifically, what she found was low cortisol levels, the stress hormone that brings us back to normal after we have an event. And she, just last year, she finds in Holocaust survivors and their children, Pamela, she finds the same genetic pattern in the same region of the same gene. I think it's the FKB5 gene, but I may have it wrong, where she can show this in two generations in humans.
So
This
is extraordinary. So you're not saying that these children are born with a predisposition to experiencing PTSD. Are you saying these children are actually born with PTSD?
The research would lead us to look that way.
Wow.
The children are born not with this clean slate, but with these inherited patterns.
Amazing.
Rachel Yehuda, I'll go a step further. She tells us that you and I are three times more likely to have PTSD if one of our parents had PTSD. And as a result, we're likely to struggle with anxiety or depression.
It's extraordinary. Well, speaking of trauma, tell us a little bit about your personal story. There was a time when you were struck out of nowhere, it seemed, with what?
About 26 years ago, I started to lose the vision in my left eye, and I got pretty scared, and I went to the doctors, and the doctors said I had an idiopathic no-cure condition. We don't know where it came from. Stress is our best guess. They called it central serous retinopathy, but I had the chronic form that only 5% of people get, which could lead to becoming legally blind, and my vision in my left eye was really sinking, and I was pretty scared. And then the doctor said, yep, it's so bad, we think it's going to happen in your right eye too. Well, at that point, I went on a search for healing. I was pretty terrified, and I tried everything, juice fasts and vitamins and hands-on healing, and everything makes it worse. And then I start just... this search leads me halfway around the globe to study with some pretty amazing teachers who changed my thinking and taught me some pretty fundamental principles, one of which was to go home and heal my relationship with my parents, which was broken. Now, how was I going to do that? Because I have this broken relationship, and I didn't know it at the time, but what was underneath this broken relationship was this pattern of anxiety, stress, anxiety, that had passed forward for generations. All my grandparents were orphaned in some way. Three of my grandparents lost their moms when they were babies or toddlers. And the fourth, she loses her dad when she's one. Well, ultimately, she loses her mom, too, because her mom's grieving. So this pattern of being broken from a mother's love, this gets passed forward into my family. And I remember being five or six, and when my mom would leave the home, I would be so terrified. I would run into her bedroom. I'd yank open her drawers. I'd pull her clothes out, her scarves, her nightgowns. I'd cry into them. I'd breathe in her scent, thinking, I'm never going to see her again, which is the family story. I'm never going to see my mother again. And I'm crying into her scarves and her nightgowns and thinking that that's it. And the most uncanny, the funniest, I guess I could say, part of this story is 40 years later, I said, you know, Mom, when you would leave and I'd be just a kid, I'd run it. She looked at me and she said, you did that too? You cried into my clothes when I left? That's what I did when my mother left. And then I knew right then and there, this was a family pattern. And my eyesight did come back, which I didn't expect it to. There was a point where I never knew. It didn't matter anymore. I just was on a journey to heal. But when my eyesight came back, I just wanted to teach these principles. And ultimately, years later, it was sat behind writing this book.
All right, so wait a minute. Let's back up a second. Your eyesight starts to fail in one eye. You go to the doctors,
yes,
and they tell you, we don't know what caused it, but you've got it, and it's incurable. And it's,
yes,
probably going to happen in the next eye, so goodbye sight. what's going on in your life at that time that you all of a sudden leave where you were living and start to travel to get help? What was going on with you?
Well, it gets worse. I'm running a business. In fact, I realized that I'm not going to do so well in this business without my sight. So I literally hand the keys to a stranger. And I just say, here, cheers, take it, because nothing really mattered anymore. You know, that adage that says your pain becomes your purpose?
Yeah.
Well, I didn't know it at the time, but I was just in pain.
Mm-hmm.
And later on, that pain would lead me through a journey of trying everything in the world to bring my eyesight back. And it wasn't until I really healed the relationships with my parents and healed that anxiety that was generational that my life improved. My eyesight came back. You know, the funny thing, Pamela, I did not need my eyesight to come back at that point. There was a period where I just felt good no matter what my eyes were doing. I remember people saying, how are you doing? And because I had done so much inner work back then, lots of meditation, lots of, oh my goodness, I remember in one of the journeys, I sat 3 days and nights on a meditation cushion, blindfolded and earplugged, just to be able to learn the way our mind tricks us into fear thinking. And I guess the idea was to just watch the mind for 3 days and nights. And it was fascinating for me. One of the things I learned is I had what I call worst case scenario mind, that my mind would always catastrophize. And my thoughts would always make everything about the worst case scenario. And one of the things, by watching it, I became friendly with it. I became friendlier in my own life with myself, really. But in the process, I became friendlier with my parents. I fell back in love with my parents, really. Remember, I'm one of those children with a break in the bond with my mom because I've inherited it, and I have 3 or 4 episodes early in life that re-engineered that break in the bond.
So it sounds like that you actually went through a profound, and profound is not even a complex enough word to describe what you went through as your eyesight was getting worse and then ultimately was restored.
It was life-changing, of course, and how would I know where it would lead me? Tomorrow I'm giving a book talk, and the funny thing is my first sentence of the book talk sentence is going to be, in my wildest imagination, I never believed I'd be up here in front of you talking about inherited family trauma, let alone writing a book about it. It's that adage again, our pain becomes our purpose, but we don't know it. We just go on a journey.
Well, during this period of time, how long, by the way, did you take to sort of go away and stay away? How long were you gone from your life beforehand?
So I took the money that I had made in the business, and I went as far as Indonesia, actually. And it was just wherever I'd read a book, I'd show up. If I read a book of some teacher that was saying something that was mind-blowing, I would join a training program. I sat at the feet of masters doing meditation. I didn't know it would help, and I didn't know where it would lead. And it wasn't like I was gone forever. It was, you know, months here, just following this inner journey, which would bring me healing so I could feel better. I just wanted to feel better. We all just want to feel better.
Indeed. Mark, we're going to take a break, but when we come back, we will pick up right here. You make the observation that no experience is ever wasted, which I think is an important one because so many people will often say, I wasted my time doing X or Y. But you say, nope, that's not true. Nothing is ever wasted. So when we return, we're going to pick up with that thought. We'll be right back. Mark Wolin, author of It Didn't Start With You, clearly there was a time in your life when your business was thriving such that you had the financial resources to walk away and to sort of craft a different experience for you. So there would be people listening who would say, oh my goodness, he wasted all that time with his business and then he just handed it over to a stranger. And yet you say no experience is ever wasted. Everything that happens to us has merit. Talk about that.
Well, see, that would not be a thought I would have had when I was young, where I thought, why is this happening to me? Why am I suffering? Only to learn that often our what looks like suffering or what looks like struggle is often a doorway into a new way of seeing something, right? The idea of losing my vision actually increased my vision when we stop the struggle. You know, we talk a lot about that word surrender, and it's not easy to surrender when we suffer. But I was forced to learn how to surrender because there was no cure for the suffering, the eyesight. What could I do? I remember sitting in the foot of this great teacher, and he'd say, is there a problem now in the present moment? And I would say, yes, in the present moment, I can't see you with my eyes. And he'd say, and he wouldn't answer me for like a month. And every day he'd ask the same question after we did these dynamic breathing meditations. Finally, I think 20, 30 days later, he looked at me when he said, do you have a problem now in the present moment? And I said, yes, I can't see. And he said, he basically lit the light for me. Well, he didn't say this, but the message was, who was I not to have eye problems? Who was I that was supposed to see? Why should I see? I never thought about that before. And in other words, I think what his exact words were, Mark, your eyes don't see as well as Goethe's, but Goethe's ears don't hear as well as Johann's, and his knees don't walk as well as Sebastian's. In other words, I got the idea that we all have something, and maybe it's that something that guides us and leads us to, number one, our compassion, our equality with other people, because everybody has something that makes us more generous in our spirit, maybe, more compassionate, more equal. That makes sense.
It does. And so for you, as you're going through these experiences, on the one hand, believing, because you'd been told, that your eyes were kind of done for, and there was no cure. And then you're moving to, well, wait a minute. I don't really have to think about that in the same way. Where did you ultimately land? How did you ultimately regain? Do you have full vision today?
You know, I'm not supposed to, but I do. I go to the ophthalmologist, and he tells me to look at the chart, and I go E, G, F, D. I see everything. And he said, wait a minute, try that again. And he looks in my eye with the flashlight, and he said, your retina is all scarred. You shouldn't be able to see that. And then he says, well, I think you must, the light must be ricocheting off the side of your eye because the direct center of your eye can't see. So I can't explain it. He can't explain it. But you ask me an interesting question. When did this happen? What happened here? Pamela, all I know is it was over time gradually. In the beginning, people would say, how are you? I'd say, how do you think I am? I'm going blind. And then the answer gradually was, how are you doing? I'd say, I'm great. And then my friends would say, but what about your eye? I go, oh, my eye. Oh, it's still doing the same thing. But the eye underneath, the me underneath the eye, was doing fine. In other words, I learned I wasn't my eye. And then ultimately, and I didn't ask it to come back. I didn't need it to come back. I was fine. Then my vision came back, which was quite a bonus. Wow.
Where were you?
When I think about it.
Where were you when your vision came back?
Well, it just stopped. It wasn't an automatic thing.
Mm-hmm.
With serous retinopathy, you get these leaks and scarring. So your retina leaks, and then you can't see because you have these globs of fluid over your fovea at the direct center. It just stopped leaking, and because it was chronically leaking. I had the chronic wet form that was just always leaking. And then one day, I don't remember exactly where, it just stopped. And then I could go to my purpose. Remember, pain is our purpose. And the purpose was teaching the principles, what I learned from some of these teachers, which was one of which is we need to have a decent relationship, a good relationship with our parents, which isn't easy for a lot of us. Because I know that we get attached to what happened in childhood a lot, and we take personally what I'm learning are our parents couldn't have been any other way because of these generational patterns. If our mom or grandmom was given away or there was a break in the bond, how could the love flow down? What I'm learning is to look beyond the behavior, in a sense, and what I'm teaching, of course, and to look what precipitates that behavior. What sits behind a dad who drinks, a mom who's distant, a dad who's harsh, a mom who's critical, parents who aren't around? Sometimes we have to look back. What I've learned is if we hold on to the story that what they did to us, if we reject them, that rejection can, what we reject in them is likely to resurface in our lives. I see it over and over again.
I see.
So in my book, what I do is I teach how to receive something good from our parents, even when very little was given.
Well, that's interesting, because for so many people, I mean, essentially, as you've just said, those early relationships that are not the relationship that one would like to have are the ones that are so powerful in our lives. In fact, we begin to see our lives through the lens of what we did not have.
Exactly. Very well said. It's this complaining and this staying in the suffering and the what feeling that our parents have ruined our lives by something they did to us that keeps us repeating these patterns of suffering. And it's, you know, I like to say that if we can look behind the what happened part of it, if we can look behind the criticism or the distance or the coldness and see what set it up, that's why I do a genogram with people where we can look at the traumas in the family and how these traumas blocked or restricted the flow of love. In other words, we can physically see that our grandmother given away and her feelings of abandonment three generations later becomes our feeling of abandonment. It was never personal. We tend to have the epigenetic component, the biological component, and then these traumas also repeat because of the traumas. It's crazy, right? The traumas happen, and so now the traumas keep repeating.
Right, right. It truly does sound like in losing your vision, you gained your vision.
Thank you. Yeah, that would be right on the money. By losing my vision, I gained a deeper vision.
Yes.
For
those who are listening, you talk about the core language approach. What is that? What does that have to do with these traumas that so many of us experience, don't know why, don't know where they came from, don't even know that there is a possibility for healing? What's core language got to do with any of that?
So when a trauma happens, clues are left behind. And these clues can be many, many ways. A body that holds the trauma with shoulders that go forward to protect the heart, or our face, the trauma show up in our face. But they also show up in our words. And these words are like breadcrumbs. It's like a breadcrumb trail, that if you follow this language, it can lead us back to the traumas, not just in our childhood, our early childhood, but also in our family history. It's like when you can uncover this unconscious language, these sentences like, I don't deserve to live, or I'll hurt my child, or I'll lose everything, or I'll go crazy, they'll lock me up. When you can uncover this sort of language, it's like finding the missing piece of the puzzle that allows the whole picture to come into view and gives us the context that explains why we feel the way we feel. So I'm fascinated. When I work with somebody, I have this four-step approach where I look at, let me just say this. I am keen on listening to the complaints, our fears, our complaints, our descriptions of our pain, our parents, all sorts of things. I outline this in the book, but I'm looking for these gems, these unconscious gems, what I call core language, that don't fit in the context of our life experience. Can I give an example?
Oh, please do.
Yeah, I once worked with this woman, and she was consumed with anxiety as soon as she became a new mother. Now, that's a piece that I'm holding as I'm talking to her, because she doesn't have any anxiety beforehand. She's functioning pretty well. But as soon as she's a new mother, bam, she is just consumed. So by asking her a few of these questions that I outlined in the book, we discovers that she has a terrible fear of harming her baby, her new baby. So I asked her if anyone in her family ever harmed a baby, and she said no. And then she said, oh my gosh, she said, my grandmother, when she was a young woman, she accidentally started a fire, and the curtains caught on fire, and the house caught on fire, and she couldn't get her newborn out of the house, and her newborn died. And we were never allowed to talk about it. We had to tiptoe around my grandmother. You never brought this up. And in that moment, she made the link that she had inherited that feeling from her grandmother. The question comes, could she have inherited from the story? Well, what I've learned is that we don't know many of these stories. In fact, this story wasn't even on her mind. I asked her, I said, did anyone? She said, no. I said, are you sure? She said, no. Are you positive? And then she said, wait a minute. I remember a story I heard once when I was a child. Well, what's more daunting is even when we don't know the stories, Pamela, even though when they're not told, when there's a family secret, when they're shrouded in pain or guilt or shame or whatever, you know, people don't talk about it. They think if I keep my lips sealed, I'm keeping the past sealed. But that's not true. We can be affected by these stories even when we don't know about them, which is why I always tell people, please talk about the traumas in your family. Please tell your kids. Please ask your parents.
If you experience traumas in the family and you choose not to talk about them, in fact, you're cementing them potentially across the family generations.
It does look that way, doesn't it? It looks like if the less we know, the more impactful those stories can express in a generation later, which is why I always tell parents to, you know, when you tell your son or your daughter that you had a sister that died, especially if you see some symptoms or some behaviors that seem connected, or
the idea that you can inherit a family trauma. In your situation, blindness was perhaps a fallout. Are there other symptoms of inherited family trauma? How would someone listening know whether or not this was something that was going on for them?
There are definitely telltale signs. So we might experience a fear or a symptom or an urge, behavior, strange impulse that strikes unexpectedly at a certain age or when we hit a certain milestone. For an age, for example, let's say our mom and dad split up at 35. And, you know, we're not thinking about that, but somewhere around 35, we feel a pull away from our partner, our spouse. We don't quite understand it. We just think we're losing interest or the relationship isn't working for us, but we don't make the connection. I one time had a client who at 26, she was married to a guy, and at 26 she goes, I'm just out of love with him. I said, well, what do you mean you're out of love with him? She says, I just feel nothing for him anymore. And when we explored her family, her grandmother at 26 became a widow. Her husband was a fisherman. He went out on to sea and he died at sea. She was 26. She never married again. She stayed alone. This woman never connected that. But as we explored it, she could see. So we did some work, actually had a conversation with her grandmother who was dead. It's interesting, but I think since I'm bringing it up, I had her visualize a conversation, a powerful conversation with her grandmother, which was very potent for her. And research now shows us that when we visualize an action or an event or a conversation, it has the same impact as actually living it. The same regions of the brain, the same neurons become activated. So by her having this conversation, something in her could come back to life, which were the feelings for her husband. And she didn't leave the marriage. She made a connection, which was vital. So we can hit a certain age, like I said, but also a certain milestone, like our woman who became a new mother and then had that terrible fear that she would harm her baby. So we could, for example, hit a milestone. We get married, and now all of a sudden we go into depression. Like some postmarital depression, because someone in the family got married and maybe they were abused, or they got married and they became a widow, or we don't know the story till we look at our family tree. Or we hit another milestone. We have a child like that woman, or we get rejected by a partner, or we move to a new place. I once had a
Mark,
let me ask
you to hold that story. We're
sure.
going to take a break, but when we come back, I want you to plow ahead with that story.
Thank you so much.
Okay. Folks, this is Pamela Brewer. You're listening to Mind Talk. Don't go away. We'll be right back. Mark Wolin, author of It Didn't Start With You, How Inherited Family Trauma Shapes Who We Are and How to End the Cycle. Mark, there was a story you were going to share with us.
So this story, it was so impactful for me. So I worked with this man who would get panic attacks so severe that he would black out whenever he'd leave his home and travel somewhere new. Somewhere new meant even going to a new restaurant. He couldn't go to he couldn't take a vacation to a new city. He couldn't go to even the new neighborhood next door because he'd black out. So I'm holding this idea of somewhere new. What does that mean? And then he dropped the bomb. And he told me that 74 members in his family died in the Holocaust. And I said to him, you mean they were taken forcibly from their homes to somewhere new, a concentration camp where they were murdered? And it wasn't until he made this connection, this link, that his panic attacks finally subsided. I mean, he knew about this trauma. He was aware of the Holocaust trauma, the whole family was, but he never made the link that he was carrying it in his genes. And then afterwards, after we did the work around it, he was no longer a prisoner in his home. Prisoner is another interesting word. He was no longer another prisoner in his home. I guess he was living sort of like those people in camps. But he was able to go to new places and take vacations with his family.
That's just extraordinary. What are some of the questions that you would ask of someone who's trying to determine what their family history is?
Well, the main thing is I want to do their genogram, their traumagram, their visual map of family trauma in the family tree. But the questions that I ask, I want to know their complaints, what I call the core complaint. So I want to, and I give exercises in the book, writing exercises, where I ask a piece of a question, you write something down. Then we'll narrow that down and go a step further. But I want to know complaints about relationships or parents or complaints about your fear. I want to know, for example, I want to know your worst fear. What's the worst thing that could happen to you if your life suddenly went off track? If your thing suddenly fell apart. So I teach people how to come up with these nuggets of core language, and then how to follow these pieces of core language into the family tree. And then once we find where this language, where our symptoms, where our fears, where our depressions, where our anxieties, where they lead to, then the whole third part of the book is about how we heal, having the experiences that are more powerful than the traumas, so to speak.
Well, speaking of healing, how does one heal? I mean, you're talking about experiences that happened long before an individual was born. How do you heal from that? Can you heal from that?
Yes, we can heal from it. You know, for some people, not all and not most, but some people just need that connection to make the link. And for those people, enough starts moving that things start to shift. For others of us, we need to have an experience that's powerful enough to override the trauma feelings, our old habit of feeling bad. So if we practice sort of the new feelings of this experience I'm talking about, we can change our brain, you know, with focus and repetition, of course. We build new neural pathways, new ways of thinking and feeling and doing and being. And several of the exercises in the book might ask you to do something powerful, to visualize something visceral in your body, or, you know, something you can feel, or maybe to visualize, like that woman who talked to her grandmother who accidentally started the fire where her baby died. And so maybe we have a conversation that's powerful enough that something begins to move because we've never said those words, imagined those words, heard those words. In the book, I teach how to do this in a new way, so the new neural pathways get laid down in our brain, so our brains can change and we can heal.
So there absolutely is hope, even if your experience is one of having been born with a family trauma. Is everyone born with family trauma?
I don't think everyone, but I think a good portion of us have something. And it only becomes a problem when our life becomes a problem, when we begin to struggle with those mysteries, those unexplained anxieties, and we can't link it, or sudden onsets. I remember working with a boy who was 7 years old. I actually worked with his mom. She called in about her son, and I had her do this particular thing that I'll tell you. He began pulling the hair out on the crown of his head when he was 7 years old. And he had pulled a whole, he was bald on the top of his head. And so I said to the mom, "Gee, tell me about age seven in your family. What happened?" She said, "That would be me. I was seven, and my mom had an aneurysm, and she died suddenly, and I felt really guilty because I'd asked her to make me some food. Mommy, make me something to eat." And she went into the kitchen, and that's where she died. And of course, the trauma was so terrible for this woman that what we do when trauma is so, so terrible, sometimes we go into a shock that leads to defensive strategies. I don't think the trauma healed all the way in this woman. She never really talked about her mother to her family, never to this boy. So part of the work for this boy was working through the trauma of this seven-year-old mom as a little girl. And what I did with her is I said, "Listen, after we do our work with your mom and the healing, tell your boy about his grandma and how his grandma blesses his head at night. He sleeps. In fact, show him a picture of a halo." You know, I think that's the image that came to me. And tell him that the halo is grandma and it's over his head because the halo was right where the boy pulls his hair.
Okay.
And so she told the boy, she showed him a picture and said, "That's grandma." And every time he then would reach up to pull his hair, it was met by a positive feeling of his grandma blessing him. And he stopped pulling his hair.
You know, I can think of, if I put my mind to it, probably at least half a dozen different diagnoses that little boy or any of the folks that you've talked about would have been given by a traditional clinician. And it sounds like, which would then result in medication and different kinds of therapy and the whole nine yards. And it sounds like you're saying that it is possible that none of that is necessary. Is that what you're saying?
I'm not saying that.
Okay.
Medication is necessary in many cases. What I am saying is a diagnosis can, not always, but it can shut down our inquiry and block our relationship with the very thing that we need to see. So if we go beyond the diagnosis, in this case, trichotillomania, pulling out the hair, and give this boy medication, if we go beyond that and get into the story, then what we can do is in some cases, these cases, many cases, go beyond the scope of what currently might only give us some resources, and we can find other. That's what I'm hoping this book will do.
Oh.
I'm hoping that it will light up, generate awareness in the medical and therapeutic communities about the impact of epigenetics. So we could see this field grow, that we could start looking at other ways of looking at cases like this, and that we can have tools to use when our patients and clients come to us with inherited family trauma, tools that work, tools I've been using for 20-some years that can be life-changing.
Well, I can certainly tell you that I was reading the book almost trying to gobble it up. It certainly broadened some of the ways in which I've been thinking clinically. So you got one convert.
Thank you so much, Pamela. That's so nice. I'm very happy about the book in the sense that I just want people not to suffer with what's been unexplained. I want people to know that there's hope. Because a lot of us don't know where to turn because the obvious answer isn't in the childhood. And we're walking around with things we can't explain that are quite a mystery to us.
Exactly. Mark, you talk about four unconscious themes. Can you tell us what you're talking about? What are those themes?
I'd love to. So I look at four ways in which, I'm going to use this word life force because I don't know a better word.
Okay.
But life force can become limited and disconnect us a little bit from our health or our relationships to a partner or our vitality, even to our financial success. Those four unconscious themes, they operate unconsciously, are when we reject a parent, and then we can either reject aspects of what we reject in that parent in ourselves, or we can, this is the first theme, we reject a parent, or we can project that onto a partner. For instance, if our parents were cruel, we can project onto a partner thinking that our partner will be cruel. Or if our parents were critical, what do we become? We become self-critical. If our parents were aggressive, we can become self-inwardly aggressive. So I know from personal experience and from working with clients, we reject a parent, it can also protract what we want to heal. So one of the tips I always give people, in fact, I'll go even a step further, Pamela. If I found anything that can immunize us from the traumas of the past, it's having a good relationship with our parents. I'll go that far.
Mm.
That's one.
That's huge.
We have... thank you. Well, that's one. Number one, don't reject. Try not heal the relationship so we don't reject parents. Number two, are we merged with one of our parents' life experience? For example, grandma gives away her first child, and we abort our first child. Or dad fails, and around the same age we fail. Or mom loses her great relationship and we lose our great relationship. These ways in which we're merged with the experience, with the life experience, or the behavior, or the situation of one of our parents. That's number two. Number three, we have a break in the early bond with our mom. And as we know from all the research that's out there in attachment, that just protracts pain. And we've got to heal these early relationships with our mom, even though we're 30, 40, 50, 60, we've got to heal these relationships so we can feel better and not continue the suffering. And fourthly, my favorite one, of course, because it's what the book is mostly about, are we identified with someone in our family history who's been rejected, left out, ignored, suffered, not talked about, and we're repeating, reliving a life that isn't ours. We're reliving their experience, and it doesn't have to be this way, Pamela.
Mark, I have to tell you, I mean, the time, quite frankly, it has all but flown by.
We're having fun, too.
Yes, absolutely. The hope that I hear that you're able to bring to folks' lives who in ways that I don't imagine many people have really thought about. You know, so often I think we've both had this experience where someone will say and believe and live, well, this is the way it is and that's the way it is and I'm stuck. And what you're clearly saying is that you don't have to be stuck. You can do something different. And that's an extraordinary gift to give to anyone. So thank you for that.
Thank you for having me here. I really, really enjoyed talking to you, Pamela.
Mark, I'm going to ask you to share either your website or a website for the book so folks can get more information, as I'm sure they will want to.
Okay. My website is markwolynn.com. That's markwolynn.com. And just thank you. I had such a nice time talking to you.
Thank you so much, Mark. I appreciate it. And I think you've written something that will change many lives. So thank you for sharing it with us today.
Thank you, Pamela.
And folks, thank you for listening to this edition of Mind Talk. You can listen to this program and any Mind Talk program again on demand at mindtalk.org. That's mindtalk.org. Mind Talk is provided daily as an educational public service, and it is not intended to replace treatment or consultation with a medical, mental health, or other professional. The managing producer is Jim Brown in 26x2 Communications. You are encouraged to send your questions or comments to me at Pamela, P-A-M-E-L-A, at mindtalk.org. That's mindtalk.org. You can also get lots more information about Mind Talk by going to the same place, mindtalk.org. And folks, remember always, if it's unacceptable, then it's unacceptable. Take care.